Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on Airs LA and the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 346 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show developed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scene and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down a love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I have been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose gardens, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my own garden library with classic design texts, memoirs and commentaries from gardeners and designers alike, and, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I've been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens across the country and around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden, and of being charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, space, light, and shade. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And, as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. For many, the quintessential European garden is an Italian one, whether in actuality or in our dreams. We start this week with an article by Kate Finnegan, published on May 28th in the Financial Times of London. Luciano Giubilei's Casa Newton is a Tuscan fairy tale. The Sienese star gardener's new landscape marks a return to his roots. Luciano Giubilei's most recent project is a homecoming of sorts. At Casa Newton, a small hotel overlooking the Val d'Orsia from the Tuscan hills, the acclaimed Italian landscape designer has created a garden of reverent romance an hour away from Siena, where he grew up. As a schoolboy footballer, Giubilei spent his weekends traveling to local fixtures across the lush valley, the peak of Monte Amiata rising in the distance. The landscape has remained etched in his memory for the past three decades he has lived in London. To come back to this area and make a garden is a very special experience, says Giubilei, winner of three Chelsea Flower Show gold medals. His atmospheric combination of meticulous green architecture and swaths of flowers is epitomized in the much-lauded gardens of Potter's House, the Mallorcan home he acquired from the late ceramicist Maria Antonio Cario in 2017. He has also conjured a Tuscan meadow for the Hermes SS24 catwalk and has renovated the 18th-century walled gardens at Rabbey Castle in County Durham, one of his biggest commissions to date. Casa Newton is a striking red brick villa built in 1846 by a descendant of Isaac Newton and opened as an 11-room hotel in 2023. Giubilei has known the owners, the architect Antoni Bertara-Kios and her husband Philippe Bertara, for more than a decade, first working with them on a garden at their neighboring winery. This new project was 4 years in the making, a timescale fairly typical of Giubilei's slow-grown schemes. It flows around the house with a kind of witty formality, slim cypresses popping up from the center of hedges like elegant surprises. In cleaning up the space, we found some old stone paths, so we started from there, says Giubilei. who took inspiration from the nearby classical Italian gardens at Horti Leonini in San Chirico, Dorcia, and Villa La Foce. A pergola in the center has been replaced with a low octagonal stone fountain. The fragrant rosemary garden, where undulating hedging and red brick walls are bordered by pastel blooms of Erigeron, Lavatera, Phlomas, and Sally Holmes roses, runs down the hillside to a swimming pool. For Bertaracchio's, the most transformative addition to the garden was the mature oak planted at the center of the circular driveway, a very ugly place before, she says. Now it's a welcoming entrance that looks as long established as the historical avenue of Cyprus. A walkway canopied by a pergola of pink wisteria leads to a spectacular view across the Val d'Orcia, inscribed since 2004 as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And to the garden's sleeping beauty moment, an old, elevated aviary abundant with white roses. It's quite rich and beautiful, but very self-contained, says Gio Bellei of the space. Context is everything. Old buildings give you an advantage. Jubilee's West London studio is housed in a converted pub on the long worktop, where his laptop sits underneath a lineup of his Chelsea certificates, is a well-thumbed copy of Soetsu Yanagi's The Beauty of Everyday Things. On the mood board opposite is a quote by Isamu Noguchi, "We are a landscape of all we have seen." His own landscapes have evolved as he has. He came to gardening by instinct. When he moved to the outskirts of Siena with an English girlfriend in his late teens, he felt compelled to grow a vegetable garden. "There was a fig tree. I put a table underneath it and invited friends for dinner," he recalls. He didn't know landscape design was a profession until his girlfriend told him it was. At 21, he enrolled at the Inchbald School of Design. He started his career as the flower supplier to Giorgio Locatelli and Gordon Ramsay restaurants. "If anyone asks me what I did in my 20s and 30s, I say, I worked. That's all I did," he says. By the late 90s, his highly structured, clean, lined gardens were in demand from Barcelona to Beverly Hills. But in 2011, he went to work under Fergus Garrett, the head gardener at Great Dixter in the Sussex Weald. Part of the intention was to be in an English garden and to find a mentor in Fergus, he says. But it was also about moving in a new direction. The formal elements of his signature aesthetic gave way to a more naturalistic planting. It was more free, says Bertaracchio's of the shift in style. There were more flowers, and it was not so strict anymore. That was when we contacted him about our first garden. While developing Casa Newton, Gio Bellei has been tending to a personal project, The Field, a half-hectare plot near his Mallorca home. He has recorded its slow cultivation on Instagram, where his 85,000 followers have watched a dry stone wall painstakingly snaking across the hillside over several months, and planting springing up so seemingly naturally it seems more like an ancient landscape stumbled upon than design. "I wanted to demonstrate a way of caring for the land in this place that is very special to me," says Gio Bellei. The spirit of The Field seems to have infiltrated Gio Bellei's whole philosophy. His 10-person strong studio is purposefully small in order that the team can maintain contact with their projects in the long term. "At the beginning of my career, it was about having a vision for the space," he says. "Now, I think about the responsibilities of going back to care for those gardens." Revisiting Casa Newton 6 years on from its inception is a beautiful experience, he says. "Sitting in the garden, I have the feeling that I have come full circle." We turn from the Tuscan hillsides back to London with our next article, written by Laura Freeman, the chief art critic of the Times of London, and published in the Times on May 31st. "The Garden Museum took me back to the 1950s in this captivating show. Benton End, a paradise of pollen and paint, recreates the magic of the 1950s Suffolk home of Cedric Morris, famed for his painting of flowers." The first time the writer Ronald Blythe was taken to Benton, and he fell in love with the place and its people. I thought I had never seen anything like it. The big scrub table and the wooden planters, the cool ochre room crammed with luster and bold oils of seabirds, formidable women fatiguing the salad and discussing plants, knowing youths, candlelight, and marmalade cats. One of the women was Kathleen Hale. Wine, a single electric bar fire sputtering before an 18th-century bread oven, and an overall feeling of Spartan grandeur, he said. Benton N., the Suffolk home of Cedric Morris, artist, plantsman, and master of irises, still stands. The house and garden are gradually being restored and open to the public, although tickets for this summer slots are all but sold out. If you have missed out this year, Benton End, a paradise of pollen and paint, at the Garden Museum in London has recreated a fantasy of Benton End. Here you will meet six characters in search of supper. They never coincided, but each was denizen of or a visitor to Benton End. Cedric Morris and his partner Arthur Lett Haynes are the exhibition's leading men. Cedric, he always went by his first name, painted and gardened. Lett ran the art school. They taught in a loose and liberal fashion 50 or 60 students over several decades of the East Anglian School of Painting and Drawing. Ernst Freud dropped off his son Lucian with the words, "Take my son, he's a wild animal." The fire that burnt down a previous incarnation of the school was thought to have been started by one of Freud's cigarettes. Joining Cedric, Lett, and Lucian Freud are the plantswoman Beth Chatto, the cook Elizabeth David, the painter Joan Warburton. As an exhibition, it's a leaf through a scrapbook rather than a comprehensive survey. Summers run together. The days seem long and hazy. The irises are always in bloom. In the modest two-story gallery space, the curator Patricia Hardy has recreated the Benton End dining room with its original scrubbed wood table and also Chatto's greenhouse. Peer inside to see photographs of her early prize-winning floral arrangements. To the right of a bright red aga, you'll find Morris's painting The Eggs, 1944, which David used for the cover of An Omelette and a Glass of Wine, a collection of her journalism. I left this evocative and convivial show craving ratatouille, resolving to plant irises, and level the earth at the back of the garden for a greenhouse of my own. Benton End, a paradise of pollen and paint, is at the Garden Museum of London from June 2nd through September 20th. The website is gardenmuseum.org.uk. We turn next to an article by Claire Coulson, published in the Financial Times of London on May 15th, about Benton End. Published in their garden section, a first look at the reopened Benton End Garden. The Suffolk Garden of painter Cedric Morris was a plantsman paradise and a heady crucible for artistic luminaries. After four decades, it has been coaxed back to life in the horticultural event of the year. 15 years ago, Christopher Woodward, director of the Garden Museum in London, was on his way to visit the rural essayist Ronald Blythe in Suffolk when he drove past Benton End. The half-timbered Tudor house on the outskirts of Hadley was where, from 1940, the artist Sir Cedric Morris and his partner Arthur Lett Haynes had lived. Here, too, they had run their unorthodox art school, where students included Lucian Freud and Maggie Hambling. As they drove past, Woodward asked his traveling companion what was left of the garden, a plantsman paradise where Morris had famously bred thousands of Benton iris seedlings and collected rare plants from around the world. "There's nothing left. It's all gone," he was told. But that wasn't entirely true. After the artist's death in 1982, the atmospheric walled garden became a wilderness of overgrown trees, shrubs, and wall-to-wall meadow. But in 2018, when Benton End came up for sale for the fifth time in four decades, philanthropists Bridget and Rob Pinchbeck bought and subsequently majority gifted it to the Garden Museum, hoping that it could be restored as a place of art and horticulture. During the COVID lockdowns, the Garden Museum's head gardener, Matt Collins, temporarily moved to the house and carefully began to cut back the overgrowth, closely observing the garden. And then Cedric's ghosts started to appear. Snowdrops, leucogyms, fritillaries, colchiums, scyllas, ornithogalums that had survived in the meadow for more than half a century flowered in succession. The vast majority of these bulbous perennials were found around a cluster of gnarly trees, a medlar, a corkscrew hazel, the purple-flowering Judas tree, and silver-leaved Eleadnus augustifolia, their low-spreading boughs creating a protective crown above the precious flowering bulbs. The trees, says James Horner, who became head gardener of Benton Inn in 2023, had been their guardians. Next month, the garden finally reopens to visitors. Its rebirth is the horticultural event of the year, an extraordinary collaborative spectacular that brings together the efforts of expert gardeners, plants people, and craftspeople across creative disciplines. Its opening is celebrated with the exhibition Benton Inn, A Paradise of Pollen and Paint at the Garden Museum. A book is currently in the works. A few weeks ahead of the opening, it's hard to take it all in when I met Horner for a first glimpse of what he and his team have created. There are shimmering swaths of bluebells and anemones in the meadow. Experimental rubble piles feature unusual plants such as Indigofera pendula, weeping indigo, Omphaloides linifolia, the pretty white Argentine forget-me-not, and furry-leaved Salvia argentii. New meandering paths and terraces in warm buff stone and handcrafted bricks transform the space into a sequence of planting styles, and the exquisite shrubs originally planted by Morris now have room to shine. One of Horner's favorites is the rare species Rosa webbiana, with its delicate foliage and pale pink flowers. While it brings together many of the precious plants Morris collected over a lifetime, it's far from a facsimile of the garden he left more than four decades ago. I don't think Cedric would admire us being too rigid in our approach, says Horner, who himself studied the Glasgow School of Art, then as the Christopher Lloyd Scholar at Great Dixter, before working as a planting designer for Luciano Giubilei. Benton Inn was an art school, and people were encouraged to find their own creative voices. It all feels radically different, and yet completely in the spirit of Morris and his almost reverential approach to plants, as much an artwork as a garden, and a sensitive reinterpretation of a singular legacy. Benton Inn was an extraordinary setup, says gallerist Philip Mould of the house in its heyday. All these young students who'd come from London or locally or from Wales being fed this delicious Mediterranean food. There was a smell of garlic and varnish in here, and a slight whiff of danger as well. The couple was openly gay at a time when homosexuality was still illegal in England. There was a sense of it being a safe place of escape, but also a place of serious creativity. Morris and Lett Haynes were creating their own utopia. Morris was born in Wales, the son of an iron magnate, and went to study art in Paris before spending the First World War working in the Army Remount Service. On Armistice Day 1918, he met Lett, as he was known, before returning to Paris, where their bohemian circle included artists, writers, collectors, Peggy Guggenheim, Ernest Hemingway, Marcel Duchamp, and Fernand Léger. Morris was a successful artist. His 1928 exhibition at Arthur-Tooth on Haymarket was a sellout. But in 1929, disenchanted with the commercial art world, the couple relocated to Pound Farm in Hingham, Suffolk, setting up the East Anglian School of Painting and Drawing in Dedham in 1937. When the building burnt down in 1939, the couple moved to Benton End. The house and garden formed a crucible for mid-century figures who lived and worked in Suffolk, including composer and conductor Benjamin Britten, tenor Peter Pears, and artist John Nash and Joan Warburton. The food writer Elizabeth David exchanged recipes with Lett, who cooked legendary lunches and dinners for students and guests. It was a mecca for plant obsessives, including Vida Sackville-West, though she refused to stay in the messy house, Constance Spry, who had returned to London with a car loaded with unusual foliage and flowers, and Beth Chatto, who was still yet to make her influential gardens in nearby Elmstead in Essex. Next month's exhibition at the Garden Museum will recreate some of the heady atmosphere of the house in the 1950s, explore the creative community that gathered around the two men, and examine the cross-pollination of ideas that impacted a generation of artists and gardeners. Cedric and Lett were open to a lot of things. Flowers, art, music, cooking, says Woodward. Apart from Freud, on whom it was completely formative, and Maggie Hambling, Benton Inn wasn't a school for great artists. It was much more about how to live. The reopening of Benton Inn itself comes after Morris's work has undergone an astonishing reappraisal over the past 7 years. Prices for his work have risen faster than for any other 20th century artist. He was the greatest flower painter of the 20th century, says Mould, who has done much to revive his reputation. His rich canvases illustrate his intimate relationship with his plants. He saw each plant as an individual. Benton Inn was a plantsman garden in which the plants were encouraged to do their own thing. And he was an inveterate collector, a constant traveler, with an obsessive, almost raptor-like focus of finding the right flowers, then hunting them down. In a 1987 essay published in the gardening journal Hortus, Chatto described the garden she'd first visited in 1952 as a bewildering, mind-stretching, eye-widening canvas of color, textures, and shapes, created primarily with bulbous and herbaceous plants. Later, I came to realize it was probably the finest collection of such plants in the country. It's an evocative image that has never been far from Horner's mind as he has developed the garden. Over 25 consecutive winters, Morris traveled throughout the Mediterranean, painting and botanizing, collecting many wild plants that would grow back in the free-draining loam soil at Benton Inn, and many were later shared with friends. Since word spread of the garden's revival, many of those plants have made their way back there. In the 1970s, the artist and plantsman John Morley would regularly visit Morris after he'd finished teaching at the Ipswich School of Art and return home with copious plants. Now, some of them have returned, including Paeonia emodi late windflower, Anemone nemorosa Cedric's pink, Virginia ciliata, along with the elegant white iris albicans, a flower that Morris had originally found in Morocco. Francis Mount, who gardened for Morris during the 1970s, has donated seed from the pink-flowered Rosa roxburghii. The provenance of these plants is so magical, adds Horner. We want them to have their time in the sun. But most exciting will be the bearded irises. Morris began hybridizing irises at Pound Farm in 1935 after visiting the iris breeder Angus Wilson. He introduced and named more than 90 cultivars, but by the 21st century, only a handful remained in circulation. Thanks to former Sissinghurst head gardener Sarah Cook, 30 can now be seen in the garden. It was no small feat for Cook. In 2004, she returned to her native Suffolk from Kent and spent more than a decade hunting for lost varieties introduced by Morris. Among those she found were Benton Nutkin, a plicata iris with standards the color of a red squirrel, the zingy, intense yellow Apollo, the pale mauve pink Cordelia, and Menace in papal purple with a yellow beard and named after one of Morris's cats. Their delicate markings and coloring, corals, pinks, lemons, mauves, have a painterly quality. In 2015, Cook showed them in a sensational exhibit at the Chelsea Flower Show. They have an elegance. They are not too far from the species, but it's the colors and the veining that draw you in, says the garden designer Sarah Price, who was so impressed by the flowers at Cook's exhibit in 2015 that she vowed to one day create a garden inspired by them. In 2023, she finally did with her trailblazing Nurture Landscapes garden at the Chelsea Flower Show, a mesmerizing display that reverberated with references to Morris and Benton Inn. The distinctive handmade pots, plinths, and landscaping features from that garden have also now found their way to Benton Inn. Price has collaborated with Horner on the redesign of the space, which was built this past winter by a team that also worked on the Chelsea garden. The plants, meanwhile, are fresh in the ground. We didn't really truly start planting until the turn of the year, says Horner, of the intense pressure to ready the garden for its big unveiling. And it has felt like every day matters. The transformation of the lower walled garden unfolds along a new 250-meter path that wends its way through woodland planting, terraces, dry beds, and a central area that will continue to develop year after year into an eye-popping meadow of bulbs, including narcissi, ornithogalum, Aphestiline lutea, the glossy red Tulipa sprengeri, and red, mauve, pink, and white anemones. Morris's paintings have provided valuable insights into his plant palette and approach. Early works suggest that he was using sea hollies and cistus in drier, hotter areas. Plants, says Horner, that would have been growing wild on nearby Orford Ness. A new sun-baked sand garden features similar drought-tolerant plants, including Eremurus, Sicilian chamomile, irises, Santalina, Stipa gigantea, and Californian poppies. When the garden opens, visitors will revel in its spring peak, but Horner has been careful to reintroduce the flowering plants that had, in Morris's day, provided a dazzling display into late summer. Jewel-toned Neophophia, Salvia, Nerine, Sunflowers, and Amaranthus. And while newly planted perennials and shrubs will take time to mature, the team has been broadcast sowing Morris's favorite poppies. They will burst into a super bloom by midsummer, including the luminous gray poppy Mother of Pearl that the artist discovered growing wild close to Benton End. Central to the watchful approach here has been to figure out what should stay or go. A towering, self-seeded ash tree has been kept, not least for the garden's birds, which were a particular passion for Morris, an environmentalist who, as early as 1960, was making protest paintings about the effects of industrial farming and chemicals on bird life. A leaning Monterey pine, likely planted in the 1980s, has been removed. Its wood has been crafted into tables. An ailing medlar tree, which brings so much character to the garden, has now been cloned, and young saplings are being trained to have the same sculptural shape. It's almost like a communion with the place, and embodying its spirit, says Horner, of the process of slowly coaxing the garden back to life. But it's also about picking the things which are still really exciting to us today. To that end, close to the house, now repainted in a coral lime wash mixed by Sudbury-based Ingilby paints, there is an experimental rubble garden, where mounds of sand, crush bricks, and stone are dissected by an extraordinary hand-formed rill built by landscaper Breffni McGeo, taking water from the roof down into a Victorian cistern that was discovered during the garden's construction. Along with an underground tank, the team is now able to harvest 12,000 liters of rainwater to use across the garden. The cistern will be planted with aquatics and provide a vital water source for the abundant wildlife. Biodiversity is at the heart of Benton End. It teems with insects, bats, bees, and butterflies. No chemicals were used during the intense work of removing decades of overgrowth. Nature has moved in, says Horner. The garden's restoration has been funded by several trusts in an appeal that raised more than £130,000 last year. The next phase, to restore the Tudor house, has won a £2.9 million grant from the Heritage Fund, which will be matched by fundraising over the next 18 months. Morris could not have foreseen how the plant palette he selected, resilient, often species plants that thrived in one of the driest parts of the country, would, many decades later, have so much resonance for 21st century gardeners who are having to rethink what they plant and how they plant it. Ultimately, the revived gardens at Benton End is all about Morris's plants. Before he died, he appointed Jenny Robinson as his plant executor so that his collection could be spread far and wide and kept in cultivation. The repatriation of so many of those plants now brings that story full circle. In Benton End, says Mould, we now have a national institution dedicated to his legacy. It's the living manifestation of the artist. Benton End, Hadley, Suffolk. Visits available to book June 4th through July 19th, gardenmuseum.org.uk/Benton-End. Benton End, a paradise of pollen and paint, June 2nd through September 30th at thegardenmuseum.org.uk. We close this week with another museum show on gardening. This is Robin Lane Fox's most recent column, published on the 28th of May. Boston Museum of Fine Arts succeeds in reframing nature. A new show sees gardens as art and artists as gardeners, and sows big ideas to inspire us all. Should gardens be framing nature? The Chelsea Flower Show has left me wondering as much, but it will take another week for me to digest what to include from it in the summer's horticultural frame. What has set me thinking is a show of a different kind, a big exhibition framing nature, gardens, and imagination, which is running at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts until June 28. Its central idea is right on target, visually dynamic, the curators state, emotionally evocative, and fully immersive. Gardens are works of art in their own right. Indeed, they are if they are gardened thoughtfully, but not if they are spaces left to cats, ground elder, and urban foxes. The Boston exhibition extends through rooms presenting gardens as art to ones featuring gardens through time, artists as gardeners, gardens as stage, taking the garden with you, and gardens real and imagined. Fascinatingly, the range of items goes far beyond prints and paintings and extends from Japan to Mexico, from China to ancient Pompeii. Flemish temistries show formal gardens in interwoven perfection. A superb silk Persian carpet made for a shah in the 1520s shows animals, flowers, and hunting as if the park is unrolling before its viewers. Artistic black and white photographs are deployed to excellent effect, presenting flowers in close-up, gardeners at work, and arresting interplays between gardens and light. I relish fine Japanese and Indian paintings that show intense respect for scholars in their gardens. AI will not make them all redundant. Flowery dresses by Dior also feature, and so does aptly decorated tableware. Between 2009 and 2016, the artist and printmaker Andrew Raftery transposed onto a set of earthenware plates 12 drawings of his mother's New England garden, one for each month. They are stylized, but evocative and quite new to me. Maria Oki Dewing, born into New York's upper class in 1845, once declared that any artist drawing from nature should serve a long apprenticeship in the garden. There are many other models in nature, but her declaration is congenial. She lived up to it by observing closely the flowers she then painted in an admired impressionist style. What about curators and historians of art? The role of flowers and garden in art is very dear to this column, dearer than to gallery directors who still do not identify the flowers in a work of art or help spectators to consider their intended relevance and meaning. The Boston show bears out a theme which sustains my devotion to gardening, the relation of plants and gardens not only to art, but to poetry, sculpture, fashion, and architecture. Visitors are encouraged to make their own connections between items from different eras and styles, set near to one another. The result is suggestive, not bossy. Framing Nature is an effective title for a show of nature framed by artists' eyes and works of art inside frames. However, it applies outdoors, too, to flowery gardens that evoke an image of nature alive in their planters' minds. There is inherent subjectivity in our term, nature, and what counts as nature. We impose on it what we see, even if it's not strictly natural, let alone wild. As for vegetable gardens, they do not fit the framing theme at all. As never in nature, they combine edible items from all over the world, making unnatural little landscapes which exist to be eaten. This weekend, like many of you, I will be finishing the garden's bedding out. In the Boston show, I relate to Oki's Dewey's painting in 1891 of red annual poppies and mignonette, two hardy annuals that I have been sowing directly into a flower bed. They have a natural look to them, as does Ross Sterling Turner's A Garden is a Sea of Flowers, painted in 1912. However, I have also been planting out marigolds, cosmos, daisies, dahlias, and begonias for summer color. In British landscapes, they never grow in nature. They are an artificial delight until late October, but a beautiful one. I will plant them in a naturalistic style while knowing they are not natural at all. This May has been a fabulous one for bearded irises, but they are hybrids, usually of Iris germanica, especially those with big heads of flower. Lemon Queen, White City, the magnificent deep blue Mer du Sud are not wild irises, but I can readily envisage them as art inside a garden's frame. My mind, therefore, responded on seeing irises, though Japanese ones, in colored woodblock prints by Japanese masters in the Boston show. I also reached out to roses, still the wonders of this summer's garden, despite such an early start for their flowers in much of Britain. An entire alcove in the Boston show is given over to a profusion of them, framed in the pattern of a truly remarkable wallpaper. In the 1850s, Edouard Muller devised a huge scheme entitled Le Jardin d'Armide, alluring to the flowery garden in which the sinister sorceress Armida seduced the hapless warrior Rinaldo in Tasso's famous epic poem, Jerusalem Delivered. The tall panels have been reconstituted against a wall in Boston and are indeed sensational. They lead their viewers' eyes through sensuous roses to a lady, surely Armida, who glistens between them. The originals were so complex and tall that few were ever commissioned. I would like a knightly castle in which to house them all in a hall and spread seductive magic whenever I walk downstairs. Until someone gives me one, I will look on double cabbage-flowered roses anew as if framed in these wondrous wall coverings. This month, I sink on evenings and at weekends inside the garden's boundaries as if in voluntary self-imprisonment. In Boston, two works of art, cleverly paired, will now frame my moments of reflection there. One is Edward Burne Jones's black chalk drawing of a climactic episode from the medieval Romance of the Rose. The pilgrim, in search of his beloved, is extending a hand in vain toward a rose in which her face is visible. But a picket fence, brambly thorns, exclude him from ever touching her. I will now see unrequited loves of the past in flowers on this summer's damask rose bushes. On the other side of the door, another striking image of containment haunts me still. In 2022, the young artist Tyler Mitchell from Atlanta, Georgia, made a big impact in London with his second ever gallery exhibition, one of Black Subjects in Nature, put on at the Gagosian Gallery. Boston is reshowing his huge archival pigment photograph, Cage, which represents a young Black lady propped on the ground and engaging us without looking directly at us. She is wearing white in a garden contained by a white picket fence, a feature of many tidy American gardens. A haze of white flowers runs below it. The backscape beyond it leads into open sky. She is not at all resentful, but her sidelong, quizzical look makes us think of how she is contained in a white setting. A while ago, in her book Green Thoughts, the writer Eleanor Perrenny proposed that men invented walled gardens in order to stop their women from straying freely. Nonsense, I thought. But as I garden, I sometimes find her notion coming to mind. Mitchell's Cage gives it a deeper twist, one of many that this fine, big exhibition has sown in me, adding to what I will see behind nature's frame. Framing Nature, Gardens, and Imagination is at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston until June 28th. MFA.org is the website. That wraps up edition 346 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program developed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send your comments to www.larrs.org or email us at oneword laradioreading@gmail.com. Give us suggestions of gardens or stories to follow, your thoughts on a favorite story you heard, or what you think about the broadcast itself. Gardens are not just plants, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us even as we try to create order and impose structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty, of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardens, other gardeners, and other times. Whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area planted around a suburban house or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky, gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time.